On this week's 51%, you'll hear more from the first openly transgender employee of an Orthodox Jewish institution. We'll also tell you about a push to rank college response to sexual assault.
When 1 in 5 women are being sexually assaulted before graduation day, schools need to be competing to be best at handling this problem.
And you'll meet a woman who creates wearable art with a message about America's obsession with body image. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Professor Jay Layden made headlines around the world when, after years of teaching literature at Yeshiva University, he returned to the Orthodox Jewish campus as a woman, Joy Layden. Her new book is Through the Door of Life, A Jewish Journey Between Genders. In her story, Layden wrestles with both the practical problems of gender transition and the larger moral, spiritual, and philosophical questions that arise. Layden is a Fulbright scholar and the author of 7 books. She is the first openly transgender employee of an Orthodox Jewish institution. 51%'s Joe Donahue spoke with Layden during her recent visit to Albany, New York. This is part 2 of a 2-part interview.
Have you changed as a teacher?
I have changed as a teacher in complicated ways. I used to talk much more about my life than I do now. So it's paradoxical. When I was teaching as a man, I would talk freely about my life, but I knew that the life I was talking about wasn't reflecting the truth of my identity. Now I feel worried about talking about my life because it does reflect the truth about who I am. And Yeshiva University has not been comfortable with any public discussion of transgender identity. There's no educational efforts. There are no student forums. It's really a one-to-one thing. So I never know what students sitting in my classes think about me or what they know about me. And I know that some Orthodox Jews would find my being transgender, like a reference to that, really distracting from and problematic in terms of the learning process. You know, I'm not there to teach gender studies. I'm there to teach writing and American literature. So I have found myself adopting a kind of uncomfortable don't ask, don't tell policy because I don't want to say anything that will make it harder for students to grow with me.
I understand not wanting to make it hard for the students, but I would think it would make it hard on you.
Yes, it does. But, you know, teachers are there for the students. That's, you know, it's my job. It's also hard on me to grade comp papers, but that's part of my job, too.
But there's a freedom and a freeing of talking about yourself that is withheld from the student now, that could be perceived, and it isn't, but it could be perceived as shame.
You're absolutely right, and it's very hard. This is one of the problems of tolerance as opposed to real inclusion. So, you know, there are a lot of places in the world where minorities are tolerated. There are people who are different, and they're not chased away or fired or persecuted, but also nobody wants to talk about their identity or acknowledge it or discuss their difference. And so there's a kind of a silence that grows up around the difference, which is very hard to distinguish from shame. And you're right, it imposes a psychological burden on the person who is different, who has to keep kind of looking at people and saying, are we not talking about my difference because you fully accept me, or are we not talking about it because you're really uncomfortable with my difference, but we've agreed to pretend that it doesn't matter? And as a teacher, it's very limiting. I mean, I want to give my students as much as I can of myself, and I can't do that as long as I've learned and grown an enormous amount through the process of gender transition and the experience of being transgender, and being unable to talk about those aspects of my experience when it's appropriate means that, yeah, that I can't share the fullness of myself with students, and that feels sad to me.
And not to oversimplify this, and I certainly don't mean to do that in any way, shape, or form, but the old adage being write what you know. And if what you know it is you, that you have to temper back in some way, shape, or form, isn't sending the right message, or at least the same message that you were sending, I assume, to students prior to the transition.
Yes, that's right. Although, the funny thing is that prior to transition, when I was acting like I was not ashamed, I really was living in shame. So it's a strange combination. It's hard for me to talk about what I think is the ultimate goal of teaching in the humanities, which is to help students learn to grow toward being the fullest human beings they can be and help them figure out what that means to them. It's hard for me to do that while having to tiptoe around and avoid so many aspects of my experience that that have been my teachers in that respect, that define for me what it means to be whole. At the same time, I feel like, you know, there are other ways of being really with people, ways that don't necessarily require that. So I'm hoping it's not a disaster.
I'm sure that you get individual questions, though, from students, right? I mean, you are honest to the students individually. It's the group that is different?
Any student who opens the conversation with me, I'm happy to talk about it with.
Mm.
And now, you know, I don't publicize the fact that I've written a memoir about this, but if you Google my name, it's pretty hard to avoid finding stuff that I've written about it. So I don't conceal it, but I think that most students, even the ones who talk to me, they come from a culture in which there really is no language for talking about transgender identity. And they're not sure whether this is something that is a source of shame for me. They really don't want to embarrass me. And so there's a kind of talking about it without talking about it. The most powerful moment for me came when a comp student at the beginning of the year knocked on my door and said, I don't know if I'm allowed to talk to you about this, but I know that you've suffered great loss and my father is dying of cancer, and you know, I wonder if you can tell me, how do you bear losing someone you love?
Hmm.
So she never said anything in the very intimate conversation that followed. I don't think either of us ever said anything about gender transition, but we talked a lot about the complicated feelings that parents have toward children when they can't be what their children need them to be, which is something I've experienced as a father, and the kind of anger and rage and love that the tangle that children feel when their parents fail them by dying or by gender transition, by changing in ways that are painful and terrifying.
I ask the question because I'm sure that many people listening at home are asking the question, which is, have you considered or would you consider going to another university where the environment is more freeing?
I would definitely consider doing that. There, I don't think that there's a great demand for tenured English professors who specialize in poetry. So if there is, I have not heard about it. But, you know, I've definitely thought about that. And it would be a great relief in some ways. I mean, I speak at schools. And my son goes to Hampshire College, which is, you know, so advanced in terms of its relation to gender that I feel old-fashioned. Mm. So, you know, it's definitely something I think about, but there are two things on the other side for me. One is that I do truly love the students that I get to work with, and I find it very exciting to work at the intersection of traditional culture and modernity, and that's what being a modern Orthodox Jew is. That's what my students are learning to negotiate. And the other thing that I would miss is... just the fact that because I'm transgender at an Orthodox university, going to work is doing something important in a way that I didn't feel before as an English professor. It kind of matters to people in the Orthodox world, particularly to queer Jews living and hiding in the Orthodox world, to be able to see someone who is openly transgender. I'm not Orthodox, but I'm a sign that Orthodox culture may someday be able to accept them living openly as who they are. And that gives my life a significance that I'm not sure it would have at another more comfortable teaching situation.
A feeling that you're making a difference.
Yes.
That was part two of Joe Donahue's interview with Joy Layden. We brought you part one in the last show, number 1301. And now we'll stay on campus, but move from yeshiva to campuses across the U.S. in general, and to a different topic, sexual assault. A women's group is trying to pressure a publisher of a well-known college guide to rank schools based on response to rape on campus. Ultraviolet is an online community of more than 500,000 women and men who want to take collective action to expose and fight sexism in the public and private sectors and the media. One of the group's most recent campaigns has been urging the Princeton Review to rank colleges based on administrative response to campus rape. Karen Rowland is Ultraviolet's campaign director.
When 1 in 5 women are being sexually assaulted before graduation day, schools need to be competing to be best at handling this problem, and the Princeton Review rankings can help do that. But instead, the Princeton Review is currently helping schools hide from their record on rape and helping them sweep these cases under the rug by failing to give parents and students the real information about what's going on campus.
Ultraviolet launched a social media ad campaign and provided a letter to the Princeton Review from 234 rape survivors. Rob Franek is senior vice president and publisher of the Princeton Review.
The Princeton Review will not rank schools based on sexual assault. What the Princeton Review, however, will do, and what it has been doing for the last month of time, is putting direct information for a little over 1,200 schools directly to their Cleary reports, which are full reports on crime on over 1,200 campuses, including sexual assault on each of those campuses. Our mission at the Princeton Review is to make sure that we're providing as much research information for college-bound students and their families, as well as current college students, and we feel that we're definitively doing that by providing information from Cleary reports.
Cleary reports are required by federal law. Institutions of higher education must publicly disclose crime and fire statistics, and Franek says those statistics are updated annually.
Schools are obliged federally to update their Cleary reports in October of each year, so we'll be putting that information up on our Princeton Review website as it becomes available.
Again, Roland.
The Princeton Review has responded to our campaign. They initially seemed very positive, looking at, you know, what they could do to protect student safety, but they've since really retreated. They've claimed that they're doing enough and they're including enough information by linking directly to what schools are saying about sexual assault on their own campuses. But the truth is that, you know, most of what the information they're including is inadequate or, in some cases, not even available.
Franek tells his side.
Our conversation with Ultraviolet was one, to understand what their ask of the Princeton Review was, and then very clearly to be able to respond to that request, which was, will the Princeton Review rank schools based on sexual assault? And our answer has definitively been no, we will not rank schools based on sexual assault.
And here's why.
Crime is a very difficult subject to categorize in a ranking. Some of the things that we've seen, and specifically with the White House task force, is that there is not consistent and uniform data being reported out per campus to create such a ranking. So what the Princeton Review has chosen to do is what we believe is our mission, is to create as much research information, not just for a handful of schools, but for as many schools as possible. And that's why I am really very proud of the 1,200 or now a little over 1,200 schools that we have full crime statistics from those Cleary reports up on our website for anybody to access.
Roland says Ultraviolet is spending tens of thousands of dollars in ads to address the issue of epidemic rape on campus.
If sexual assault doesn't rank with them as student safety, I'm not really sure what they, you know, what they think student safety is.
The campaign is part of a larger effort by Ultraviolet to combat rape culture across the United States, holding universities who have egregious records on responding to sexual assault accountable.
I am beautiful, no matter what they say. Words can't.
The following is a production of This Land Press. For more information, visit thislandpress.com. American women's fear of body hair and the pains they take to be rid of it reveal much about our attitude toward beauty. Erica Rasmussen creates clothing using hair and other objects that will eventually decompose. Her wearable art confronts our history of body image obsession and fears of aging and physical decline. She talks about her work with Abby Wendell.
Can you just list off some of the materials that you use in your work?
Oh, sure. Let's see. Poodle hair, watermelon seeds, dehydrated cherries, human hair, silk suture thread, apricots.
Blood. That's true.
Blood. That's right. Bovine blood. Yeah.
Erica Rasmussen uses these materials in what can most simply be described as clothing sculpture. From a distance, she makes corsets and dresses and coats. But up close, her corset is covered in matchsticks. The interior of her jacket is lined with dehydrated cherry tomatoes. And her little black dress? It's made from the kind of paper you sit on at a doctor's office. Her work is detail-oriented and labor-intensive. It gives her a lot of time to think about the sacrifices Americans make to be beautiful, about living in a body that one day is going to get sick, and about how to die with grace. We begin our conversation with Rasmussen describing a sculpture she calls Dirty Little Secret.
It's a dress, and it's kind of fleshy in tone, and it has these polka dots all over it, and it hangs in space. It rotates from fish line, and underneath it, I pour a ring of horsehair, little clips of hair, and it's about secret X-ray hair removal. Do you know anything about that?
I do not.
Well, apparently when the X-ray was invented around 1900, people soon found that hair effortlessly, painlessly would fall out. And so these clinics were set up all around the United States, and women would go to these clinics, be exposed to the X-ray machines, and it was a way of controlling their body hair and sometimes their facial hair. The women who practiced this X-ray hair removal eventually became sick. But this little dress that I fashioned is a poignant example, I think, of how dangerous the pursuit of beauty in this culture can be. It can be, especially because we're so technologically driven, right? Certainly all cultures modify the body in some way, and all cultures have visions of ideal beauty. But this particular piece, you know, from a distance, it kind of calls you in. It's a nice feminine shape. But then you get up closer and you discover there's something wrong here. Yeah, and I like that tension between that which is beautiful and grotesque.
I read something on your website that said your work addresses, but it also dissolves fears you have about your body.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what kind of fears you've had.
Mm. When I was a little girl, my father told me that eating tomatoes would make me big, strong, and hairy-chested. I stopped eating tomatoes for 20 years. My brother went on to eat tomatoes, and you should see how hairy he turned out.
Did you like tomatoes as a child?
No, I don't think I was a really big tomato fan.
So it wasn't like a battle for you? It just kind of like, well, I don't want that.
That's right. I mean, I think I recognized from a very young age that men had very different grooming practices and physical attributes than women. And I think one of my larger fears is about being masculine or unattractive. And certainly that whole idea of excess bodily hair, you know, was quite terrifying to me as a young person. I'm a big woman. I'm 5'10". I have size 11 feet. I have dark hair and pale skin. So sometimes dancing between masculinity and femininity is a little tenuous, you know? So I have a lot of fears, and some of them are far more common. You know, I'm afraid of death. And there was another piece you saw on the show called The Beginning of the End, which is a work that harbors my first gray hair.
Yes, this what you're talking about is it's like a little memory box.
Right.
And it's got a photo of you dressed up in your mom's clothing.
Right.
And then curled up in the box is your first silver
right.
hair.
Gray hair, yeah.
Well, when did you find it? Where were you? What were you doing?
I was in London doing research with my husband, and he was helping me do something like part my hair in the back or I don't know what, but he found it. And I was 28. I kept that gray hair in an envelope probably for 10 years or more until it occurred to me what I would need it for.
And how did you know when you were ready?
Once I settled into my 40s and there were more gray hairs.
There's hair in another piece that I want to talk about. The Book of Desires?
Book of Desires.
The Book of Desires.
Yeah. It's modeled after 16th century Flemish neckwear. So think of big collars and round ruffs, right, that used to be worn by nobility and so forth.
Yeah, like Elizabethan
Yeah. It started in the 16th century. I began making that shape really as a physical challenge, just to see if I could make such a collar. But then my mom became sick. This was 8 years ago. She became ill with breast cancer for the second time in her life. And when I knew her hair was going to fall out and that she was going to have to go through chemotherapy, I asked her to save her hair for me. And I used her silver or her white hair. I threw in little pieces into my paper vat and I pulled charcoal or black sheets of paper. And then I ran these sheets of paper through my inkjet printer with prayers or wishes. I hope that my mother will see Venice. I hope that she'll spend time in her garden. I wish that she can see her grandson grow. And although I found that my attempts to enlist magical forces may not have worked, she's not healed. She's not fixed, you know. I have found that making these objects helps me.
So close in summer, it's too high, it's too
That concludes our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1302.